So you had a specific district. Did you work alone in that district?
Yes. I had part of the Central Valley and the Southern Sierras, and I was fortunate enough. I had horses, and I did a lot of the backcountry patrols on my horses. So I'd go in, pack my horses in for 4, 5, 6 days at a time, and get to experience that part of it. I had the Golden Trout Wilderness was in my first district, and that's only accessible by either backpacking or stock. There's no roads, there's no vehicle traffic or anything, so that's the way you get in there, was by horseback.
So being that you're a woman, being in those situations alone, do you think you experienced that any differently than the male wardens might have?
I didn't. I really didn't. I can't even give you an example of where I felt that being a woman made it different. I think the key to that is competency, confidence, having a level head, and I felt that I was treated the same. I never had an experience where I felt I was treated differently.
So, taking the gender thing out of it, it still sounds like it could be a little scary back there.
It's absolutely a dangerous job. Absolutely. Whether you're male or female. Because our backup is hours away, if we even have it. I'm sure you've heard this from a lot of the retired wardens that you've interviewed, but most of the people we contact are armed, whether they're legally armed or not. So there's that aspect of it to where when you approach somebody, you don't really know who they are until you've made that contact. You know, are they a legitimate sports person that's carrying a gun because they're hunting? Or in this day and age, are they a gangbanger that's out shooting out of their car, shooting ducks off the pond or whatever? You have to have that sixth sense and approach things mindfully and carefully and safely, because you're not in an area where your backup is just two blocks away and he's going to get there in his patrol car. And that's even if you can get out on your radio, you know, because we're in a lot of very, very remote rural areas, excuse me, where a lot of times we can't hit a repeater on our radio. So that's where being very cautious and very aware of your surroundings is what is your survival.
It does. It actually sounds like there's a lot more dangers or potentially than a lot of other fields of law enforcement.
And I think a lot of it is people skills, because I think a lot of one of the biggest officer safety benefits you can have is not being that officious law enforcement officer and approaching the situation with an open mind, knowing that, yeah, you may have a violation here, but you treat people the way you would expect to be treated. Even if they have violated, you're still going to do your job, and the end result's going to be the same. They're either going to get a ticket or they're going to jail. And a lot of times if you approach it in that manner, professionally, not cocky and officious, and accelerating a situation that didn't have to go to that level because of your attitude, it keeps you safer. And I'm not saying that if they, you know, are uncooperative and they start being the jerk, you have to always be one or two or three steps above them as far as your control and your command presence. I'm not saying back off or back away, by no means. It's just a matter of how you approach people. They could be the worst person in the world, but if you approach them in a certain way where you're professional and respectful, you're still going to take them to jail. You're still going to take their gun away. But you haven't created a situation that didn't need to be created.
Did your role change over time?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I was in uniform patrol for 14 years. I was a canine officer, and so I got to experience a lot of different ways to do my job. Canine officer, did the horse patrols. And then I started doing a part-time undercover detail with our special operations unit. And they didn't have a full-time team at the time because of budget, so they would borrow uniformed officers from the field for 3 months at a time. And then you'd go back to patrol. And then if you chose to, you could go back and help again for another 3 months. Well, I did that about three times, and that's when I realized this is what I want to do. I wanted more of a challenge. I loved my district. I loved the uniform. I loved patrol. I loved being a canine officer, but I was ready for more of a challenge. So I eventually transferred to the Special Operations Unit full-time because budget allowed to have a full-time 10-person team. So that was completely different. I went from overt, uniform, canine officer to covert, undercover, surveillance. So it was like a complete 180 in how you did your job. And I did that for a couple of years, and then I ended up being the supervisor of the unit, and that was my last 11 years of my career was spent in undercover and the supervisor.
So tell me a little bit more about undercover, because that sounds pretty exciting.
It is very exciting. Our team is responsible for investigating all the illegal commercialization of wildlife in California. And California is so diverse. I mean, we have the deserts, we have the oceans, we have the valley, we have the mountains. So we have just about every critter imaginable that some states don't have. You know, we have our reptiles in the desert, we have all our marine fisheries, we have all the big game in the mountains, we have all the upland game and the warm water fish. So, and a lot of those are extremely valuable on the black market. And for instance, some of the priority species that our department recognizes and what we ended up working the most were abalone, because it's worth so much on the black market. And Northern California has the last viable red abalone population in the entire world. Everything else has been decimated, either by poaching or pollution or disease. So we no longer have a commercial industry. We had to close it because of the declining populations, but we still have a sport season, which is highly regulated. And that is probably one of the most poached fish or wildlife in California because it's worth so much on the black market. It's very popular in the Asian communities as aphrodisiacs, that it's used for medicinal purposes. The traditional Chinese medicine recognizes it as being able to do so many things, so it's got this huge demand. And you know, it's nothing for somebody to get $100 per abalone. So that was huge to us. Probably the second most highest priority is sturgeon, our white sturgeon in the Delta, because of their roe, which is what the caviar is made out of. And that's, you know, a mature egg-bearing female is worth $5,000 on the black market if you consider her eggs and her meat.
So as far as the undercover work, would you go in and act as a...
Both. We would either make a surveillance case if we weren't able to infiltrate the particular poaching rings, where we would actually watch and document everything they're doing and document the sales enough to where we have enough evidence to arrest them and take them before the judicial system. But a lot of covert operations where we actually infiltrate them covertly. On the covert side, lots of exciting things. We had some of the longer-term covert investigations that were very stressful because whether it was me that was undercover or supervising somebody, you always worried about them. You weren't always in contact with them, even though we had all these different safety measures to try to maintain contact as much as possible. When you're inside, lots of exciting things. We had some of the longer-term covert investigations that